Hello, my name is Ruben Mesa, and I'm the Executive Director of the Mays Cancer Center at UT Health San Antonio MD Anderson. And I'm pleased to be speaking with you today regarding the expanding role of JAK inhibition as a cornerstone of therapy for myelofibrosis. Here are my disclosures. Well, let's begin with a case. So this is a gentleman diagnosed 14 years ago at the age of 40 with polycythemia vera. It was discovered after having a thrombotic event. It was treated with phlebotomy and aspirin and hydroxyurea. Now comes to see you as a hematologist at age 54. The patient complains of worsening fatigue, night sweats, a loss of 5 kilograms, and with significant splenomegaly, 13 centimeters below the costal margin. This individual, the blood counts show some mild anemia, hemoglobin of 9, white count of 14,000, platelets of 105,000. On the peripheral smear, the individual has increased myelocytes, metamyelocytes, and 1% blasts. There is splenomegaly, both by exam as well as confirmed by ultrasound. They're significantly symptomatic. With an MPN 10 score, the patient-reported outcome scores for patients with MPNs of 35 out of 100. And the bone marrow shows 2 to 3+ fibrosis. There's no increase in blasts, a deletion 20q in terms of cytogenetics. And by next generation sequencing, it shows the JAK2 V617F mutation, mutated at 30%. And there is also a TET2 mutation that is found as well. So many questions arise for you. This patient now with post-PV myelofibrosis. How do we assess risk? When should we consider allotransplant? Should they begin on medical therapy? From my end, I like to think of these diseases both as incorporating issues of disease burden as well as risk. In terms of risk, by the Dynamic International Prognostic Scoring System, there's 5 criteria that are used to judge risk. Age over 65, leukocytosis, anemia, significant symptoms, or increase in blasts. This individual has intermediate 2-risk disease. By disease burden, I think both about how long someone's going to live, but what is the burden they're facing? The symptoms, splenomegaly, anemia, risk of progression, movement toward acute leukemia. This individual has 3 of those 5. So if we start this individual on medical therapy, and ruxolitinib would be the standard medical therapy we begin, what is the current dose? So how do we make these decisions? Well, I like to think that these individuals have a heterogeneous disease course and a variable burden. As I mentioned, for this individual, we consider vascular risk, and they've had one in the past. Cytopenias, this individual has mild anemia. Splenomegaly, it can cause symptoms, it can be linked with the biology of the disease and progression. There can be difficult symptoms linked with inflammation and the biology of the disease. It can be risk of progression to acute leukemia. And all of this occurs in the context of the individual's baseline health and comorbidities. Now, as we manage and develop a treatment plan, we, as I mentioned, have an accurate diagnosis, ideally, and assess survival and disease burden, and develop that treatment plan. Should they move to stem cell transplantation or frontline medical therapy? At age 54, I would typically have such an individual visit with our bone marrow transplanters, have an active discussion, consider whether they would move to transplant in the near future, distant future if the disease progresses, or are they not a candidate due to comorbidities or by patient choice? If they progress from frontline medical therapy, do we move on with salvage transplantation, second-line medical therapy, or accelerated or blast phase management? Now, frontline medical therapy has been, for the greater part of the last 10 years, ruxolitinib. And that was the first approved therapy for myelofibrosis, a JAK1 and JAK2 inhibitor, and approved on the basis of successful trials of ruxolitinib versus placebo or compared to best alternative therapy. We saw significant improvements in the size of the spleen as well as improvement in disease-associated symptoms, either in aggregate, as you see by the waterfall plots on the left, or according to individual symptoms, as you see on the right. We've also seen over time a significant improvement in survival. This is likely multifactorial. Decreased clonal evolution, improved performance status, decreased debilitation. We have learned over time that to achieve survival benefit, there likely needs to be a significant response, and that dose matters. Values or levels of the drug less than 10 milligrams twice a day likely have a lower efficacy for improvements of spleen or symptoms. And if we've learned anything over time, is having an adequate dose of the drug is important, as well as important to have a true response. We have been able to correlate that the spleen volume reduction is tied to improvements in overall survival. So takeaway one I would give you is, first, achieving a spleen response matters for overall survival improvements in myelofibrosis. Second, use the product dosing guide for your starting dose and increase if needed to achieve the optimal dose. There is way too much underdosing of ruxolitinib, which is currently occurring. A 5 milligrams twice a day or 10 milligrams twice a day in suboptimal responders because of concerns about initial anemia. It is best to manage the patient through that initial period of time, let the hemoglobin come back, even give a transfusion if it is necessary. That will probably lead to more efficacy, better response, better outcomes for the patient. So this individual is begun on 5 milligrams twice a day and is improvement, but neither a response. So when do we increase the dose? If the patient started at 15 twice a day and they dropped, should we stop? Should we dose modify? Should we support? I would recommend in these situations that we continue the patient on the 15 milligrams twice a day. The drop in the hemoglobin is an on-target effect. Inhibiting JAK2 inhibits erythropoiesis, and there is some degree of recovery. So I think over time we've learned patience in terms of maintaining the dose to achieve an adequate response. We've learned that the development of anemia does not affect the response to ruxolitinib treatment. So even though they develop anemia, it does not worsen their outcomes. In fact, maintaining through it, the outcomes are the same. This is different than baseline anemia. People ask, well, in the DIPSS, anemia is a negative prognostic marker. Isn't that the case if you develop JAK inhibition-induced anemia? We believe that is likely distinct. The prognostic value of anemia is particularly in the baseline setting. So advice in terms of managing those early onset cytopenias: stick with your dose, support them as appropriate. Over time, if that persists, we might either add an additional agent. Danazol has been added with success in clinical trials. Erythropoietin stimulating agents in individuals that have a suboptimal erythropoietin response. So if they have an EPO level, particularly under 100, but by NCCN guidelines, if it is less than 500. Additional options, considering adding either steroids or thalidomide to ruxolitinib for individuals with cytopenias. So takeaway two, optimizing the dose is important for maximal benefit from ruxolitinib. The baseline anemia does not lessen the benefit, nor will subsequent anemia. Dose increases in patients with thrombocytopenia have been tolerated and efficacious when starting at lower dose. So for example, if there is an individual who begins at 10 milligrams twice a day because of lower platelet counts, or even 5 milligrams twice a day, increase that dose as tolerated. There have been individuals with marked thrombocytopenia that have gotten as high as 20 twice a day or 25 twice a day. We don't begin them at those levels, but many people will tolerate that. The thrombocytopenia does not tend to be progressive. Now, the JAK inhibitor landscape has expanded from ruxolitinib, and I'll focus my next comments on fedratinib, which is now approved broadly for both either the frontline or the second line setting. Subject for different talk are other JAK inhibitors in the pipeline, but we'll mention there's both pacitinib from CTI that is having activity in people with marked thrombocytopenia in the myelodepleted phenotype, or momelotinib, which also inhibits ACVR1, may inhibit hepcidin, may help to also improve anemia, and is in current phase 3 trials. Now, fedratinib has been approved since the fall of 2019. It is an oral JAK2 inhibitor and was tested for individuals with platelets greater than 50,000. It's approved off of the basis of two studies, the JAKARTA and the JAKARTA 2 study. And I had the honor of being involved with both of these studies. The JAKARTA study was the frontline JAK inhibitor naive phase 3 study of two different doses of fedratinib versus placebo. Both doses were superior to placebo. 400 milligrams a day was the best combination of response in terms of spleen volume reduction, symptom burden reduction, and tolerability. In terms of side effects, it can lead to anemia or thrombocytopenia, as there can be with other JAK inhibitors. There can be GI side effects, and typically do prophylax with Imodium or anti-nausea medicines. There's a rare incidence of Wernicke's encephalopathy, less than 1%. And on that basis, there is a black box warning that recommends assessing thiamine levels, replacing thiamine levels if low, and monitoring for this. With thiamine replacement and monitoring, we feel that this likely will not be a major issue for myelofibrosis patients. It has been incorporated in the NCCN guidelines, both as frontline therapy. And as I'll show you, we particularly consider in individuals with moderate thrombocytopenia of 50 to 100,000 platelets because it can be given at full dose. It can be used in the second line setting and is the sole approved option in the second line setting for myelofibrosis. What does using it in the front line look like? Well, if I decide to start fedratinib, where they get 400 milligrams a day, we assess thiamine levels, and replace thiamine if the levels are low. I largely have patients take thiamine anyway. It's very inexpensive. It's easy to take. It's pretty non-toxic and can adjust over time. I will give them PRN, nausea and diarrhea drugs. Most patients are able to discontinue those. And then we start the therapy and monitor for any GI toxicity, monitor for thiamine levels, and of course are monitoring for response by blood counts, spleen size, and symptoms using the MPN-10. Now, I mentioned that individuals with a moderate thrombocytopenia were able to dose at full dose. And Dr. Harrison and I presented with colleagues a combined abstract for ASH of 2019, looking at individuals who received 400 milligrams of fedratinib with a platelet count of 50 to 100,000. We identify here the group of individuals that fell into that category from the JAKARTA study. Baseline characteristics were fairly similar with obviously very active disease regardless of the platelet count. In terms of response, we saw very solid response rates for spleen volume reduction and symptom improvement in individuals with marked thrombocytopenia, and that there was no significant increase in toxicity in this group, and they were able to be dosed at full dose. Why this matters is that for 50 to 100,000 platelets, we typically do dose reduce ruxolitinib, and there may well be an advantage to fully dosing this group of individuals. This showing improvement in the spleen volume for this group of individuals with moderate thrombocytopenia. Now, what about second line? Well, ruxolitinib has been approved and was approved as a sole agent from 2012 through 2019. So certainly there is great experience in the community using it. So what is failure? Well, I like to say that failing a drug is very much dependent upon what the other option is. If you've got many other options, the bar for failing is probably lower. If you don't have any other options, the bar for failing is probably quite high. Things I consider in terms of this discussion is dose, cytopenias, spleen size, etc. There is a robust pipeline of new therapies being looked at for second-line therapy. I had mentioned the other JAK inhibitors in development. There are multiple other approaches, many of them in combination with a base of JAK inhibition. That might be ruxolitinib, that might be fedratinib. But in cell cycle checkpoint inhibitors, anti-fibrosing agents, other tyrosine kinase inhibitors, agents impacting the apoptotic pathway, immunomodulation, or a lot of activity with epigenetic modifiers, with drugs such as LSD1 inhibitor from Imago, the BET inhibitor from Constellation Pharmaceuticals, all being in advanced clinical trials. I mentioned that fedratinib was approved off of the basis also of a second-line study. There was the JAKARTA-2 study led by Professor Harrison and I. We had reported an initial response rate, but then conducted a reanalysis in 2019 using stricter, more modern criteria of what it meant to respond, what it meant to fail ruxolitinib, and having an adequate trial of the drug to be able to assess. We presented these results at ASH 2019 and had three cohorts: an overall intention to treat population, those that had failed RUX by more modern criteria, and a sensitivity cohort, that group that had both failed by modern criteria and had had a sufficient trial of fedratinib to know the benefit. Here, showing the waterfall plots, you see the improvements in spleen and symptoms, showing significant activity and response in roughly 27 to 30 something percent of the individuals. So it is an exciting time for new options for patients with myelofibrosis. We have ruxolitinib that we have learned much about, to use an adequate dose to adequately achieve a response. We have fedratinib, an option in particular for consideration for individuals with moderate thrombocytopenia, and most clearly as an option in the second line setting. I would encourage you, if you have individuals that have failed ruxolitinib, you don't have a good clinical trial, you should definitely be considering fedratinib. And we have a robust pipeline of new options being developed. There will be options for patients with myelofibrosis. Looking into the future, I think we really will have a base of, one, the patient optimizes their JAK inhibitor. Is that RUX? Is that fedratinib? Is that some other agent? And then two, in select individuals based on response, molecular profile, or other parameters, we will then add in another agent, a BET inhibitor, an epigenetic modifier, or some other approach. So with that, I'd like to conclude, but certainly thank all of my colleagues. We all participate in trials together. There is much team science in the MPN arena, and our work regarding quality of life led by our MPN Quality of Life Study Group. Thank you.